Welcome to the Latter Gay Stories podcast, the show that features real people, real stories, and real talk. Now, here's the voice of the show, Kyle Ashworth.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Latter Gay Stories podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Ashworth, and you are at the intersection of sexuality and religion, where it meets at the intersections of LDS Street and LGBTQ Avenue. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for giving us a little bit of your time to better understand this experience. We have a fabulous and excellent episode for you today. As always, I know I do say that a lot, but today we do. And I'm excited to have our guests with us today. If you are watching on a video version of this podcast episode, there is a comment section where you can leave comments as the episode unfolds, and we can have a real-time chat with the other audience members who are watching this episode. So we invite you to do that. We also invite you just to share your comments. Is there something that's being talked about that resonates with you? Do you have a question? Do you have a comment about it? Feel free to leave feel free to add your comment into the comment section. And not only will we respond to it, but I think it's cool that each of those people who are watching this video episode will be able to have this interaction. Even after the premiere of the episode, there are still people who have that interaction through the comment section. So we invite you to do that. And if you are watching on the audio version of listening on the audio version of this podcast through one of our audio podcast players like Stitcher, iTunes, Google, iHeartMedia, or one of the others, we invite you to subscribe to the channel. Those who subscribe through the audio version of the podcast player, I do tell you, you will get your audio podcast a little bit sooner than the video version. So that's always exciting for those who subscribe on the audio version. And again, if you haven't yet, please leave us a rating wherever you are listening to this podcast. Now, I want to introduce you to our guest today, which I'm super excited to have. You know him as the Naked Pastor. And fortunately for all of us, you're fully clothed. David Hayward, welcome to the Latter Gay Stories podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on the show. And hello, everybody.
And so you're all the way down into the studio from Canada.
That's right.
From Toronto, Canada.
No, I was born in Toronto, but I'm actually much further east. I'm on the far eastern side of Canada, so near St. John.
All right.
New Brunswick.
I remember Toronto somewhere. Somewhere in that story was Toronto.
That's right.
From the far north, you are here in the Latter Gay Story studio and here to share a little bit about your story, which I think is fascinating because you weren't raised Mormon.
No.
You have no Mormon background. But somehow you have been able to penetrate these religious circles through your art and also through theology.
Yeah.
Which I think is super exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. There's a lot of Mormons and ex-Mormons, ex-Mos, I guess they're nicknamed, who follow my Instagram and so on. And it's pretty fascinating. I've even had some Mormons ask if I could tweak or edit my cartoons a little bit to show a temple instead of a church or whatever. So it's pretty interesting. Yeah.
So is that in the cards? Are we going to see a temple show up?
I have done a couple. Yeah.
I do know the artist who writes Pickles is a Latter-day Saint, and sometimes you will see a temple in the background of the Pickles episodes, the Pickles cartoons.
Yes, that's right.
So that totally useless trivia.
Yeah.
So David, tell the audience a little bit about yourself. Aside from Canada, who is David Hayward?
David Hayward, I was born and raised in Canada mostly. Grew up in a religious home, Christian home, and grew up with my father being an artist on the side. He did painting and stuff, so I've always drawn and painted and things like that. But I was very, very heavy into Christianity, youth group, ended up going to Bible college from Canada to Springfield, Missouri. And that's where I met my wife, Lisa. It was a Pentecostal Bible college. From there, I went to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in Boston, got my master's in New Testament studies, you know, studied Greek, Hebrew, all the original languages. Then I went to University of Toronto to start on my PhD in New Testament studies, and we got pregnant. So we took an easy way out and went into the ministry. So I kind of accidentally ended up in the ministry. It's kind of weird. But I served as a pastor for about 30 years and in the Presbyterian Church in Canada, in an independent church, and also in a vineyard church. And so I'd been serving roughly 30 years as a pastor when in 2010 I decided to leave the ministry. and put all my efforts into Naked Pastor full time, which had been going on for about 5 years already. I started the blog in 2005, and it took off. And that's what I've been doing full time since then.
And I want to talk about that genesis. So yeah. 5 years prior to you leaving the ministry,
right.
there was this idea that you wanted to start drawing.
Right.
What were the, and the drawing is cartoons
right.
that we've, many of us have seen.
Yeah.
What were the designs in the beginning? what were the genesis designs of your cartoons?
They're terrible. I look back on my first cartoons and it was like hilarious, you know, me just trying. I was inspired by other cartoonists. My gold standard for a great cartoon is The New Yorker. One frame, very simple, usually black and white, often few or no words. And so that's what I strive to achieve, that kind of quality. So when I look back on the early days, you know, it was kind of funny and kind of, you know, cringeworthy. But I caught on pretty quick, and people started noticing my cartoons. Like my blog up until, you know, 2005 when I started and everything, and 2008 or so flew under the radar. But then a couple of my cartoons caught attention and went viral. And then all of a sudden, people started noticing my cartoons. My own congregation didn't even read my blog. They're like, we have to listen to you every week. Why should we read your blog? So I just, you know, was kind of cartooning and blogging under the radar, but some of them got noticed. In 2009, I had a profound sort of, I don't know what to call it. It wasn't supernatural or anything. It was just this profound moment where I saw the unity of everything and the oneness of all things and the connectivity of everyone. And I started sharing that on my blog, and that sort of led to the denomination expressing concern about, you know, where the direction I was going in, and I knew my time was up. And sure enough, a year later, I felt compelled to leave the ministry and the church.
Yeah, and that's really what I was interested in too. I wondered the content of your cartoons
yeah.
in the early days.
Yeah.
Because today what we see often in a lot of your drawings are messages that would probably make traditional pastors cringe a little.
Yeah, yeah.
Cringe with self-inflection.
Yeah.
Also, you draw a lot about deconstruction.
Yeah.
You draw a lot about, often your cartoons deal with the intersection or the collision between mm-hmm. religion and sexuality,
yes.
how religion no longer is serving the marginalized communities.
Right.
Were those the types of cartoons you were drawing 5 years prior to leaving the ministry, or was it more just simple religious-based?
Well, I started to address things that I felt were plaguing the church most. And so I was cartooning a lot about pro women, theology, like the inspiration of scripture and so on, and then LGBTQ plus reality and spiritual abuse. And so those were probably the big four. And yes, there are a lot of pastors, imams, rabbis, priests, who follow my blog as well, who appreciate my cartoons because they are aware of the systemic kind of abuse that's occurring in the church and in religion generally. And so that's where I think my cartoons sort of caught on, was they were addressing a major issue. I wasn't just being nitpicky. I felt I was going after some of the major issues that were plaguing the church to an extent that it was going to cripple it in walking into the future.
I think it's a great way of doing it. What
yeah.
what motivated you to get there? Because, I mean, very, yeah. very candidly, you are working as a pastor.
Yes.
And this is your income. This
yes.
is your livelihood.
Yes.
This is your identity. This
You're
is
right.
everything.
Yeah.
And now something leads you to alienate
yeah.
the very thing that is sustaining you.
Well, fortunately, I was in a church that I never felt I was, I always gravitated towards churches that accepted me as a fellow journeyer, somebody who was traveling along with them, not as a top-down sort of a, guru or preacher or teacher or whatever. I felt we were growing and traveling together. And so the last church I pastored when I was really starting to blog really was, you know, we were in the same, on the same kind of a page. And I was talking about this stuff publicly in my sermons and so on about, the systemic issues of the church and how it's important for us to be our most authentic selves. You see, I think the driving force for me has always been, I want to be free to be me. And so when I was constantly encouraging other people, you need to be free to be you. You're free to be you. And I don't even have to give you permission. You're just free to be you and your own authentic self. And for me, that included everyone, including my gay or trans friends or whatever. And so I think that's the driving kernel of what I'm about, is you are free to be your and express your authentic self. And so everyone who is like, in the closet spiritually or gender-wise or sexually or whatever, I want them to feel safe around me to be their most authentic self. And that, of course, ran into conflict with the church, because the church and church leaders, my experience and observation, wants conformity and compliance. Yeah.
And as you're talking about that, the question that keeps popping up in my mind is that ability to recognize a marginalized community, is that the naked pastor speaking, or is that David speaking, or was there a time where David had to catch up to where the naked pastor was at? Was there a transfer there of ideology that allowed you to recognize and embrace the marginalized communities?
You know, it's interesting. It's kind of like naked pastor. I accidentally fell on the name. My first blog was, can you believe it? It was called churchpundit.com. And I didn't like the name. It sounded so pretentious, And I at that time, Naked Chef, Naked Archaeologist, The Naked Truth, all those were kind of popular at the time. And so I Googled Naked Pastor, and the website was available. And I think I accidentally entered my name into an auction. I didn't even realize. But I got an email saying, congratulations, you won the auction for the URL, nakedpastor.com. And I thought, oh, and it says, open to see your invoice. I thought, oh, no, because websites cost thousands of dollars. Anyway, it was $60.
Wow.
Nobody else wanted it. So I went with it. And so that was just me, blogging, essentially logging online. It's your online journal. And so that's why I called myself the Naked Pastor. I wanted people to see behind the curtain, to see the real me, a real pastor in the real church with real conflicts, real doubts, real struggles, And so that Naked Pastor was really me venting and expressing my truest self. And I think me feeling that kind of freedom to be me, my most authentic self, attracted other people that wanted that same kind of freedom.
I'm curious about how your, we talked a little bit about how your congregation reacted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how your wife reacted to this immediate turn into, from pastoral care to artist and envisioning.
Yeah. Lisa is a saint, an angel. You know, the fact that she's a hospice care nurse says a lot. She really is a compassionate person. And we have been madly in love ever since she was 18, I was 20. We got married when she was 19, I was 21. And we were joined at the hip all the way through.
You should have been Mormon. Brigham Young would have loved that. Young.
I know. I love saying I married a teenager. But we were, madly in love. We still are, even more so. But, I say but, because when I left the ministry in the church, that threw a bomb into the middle of our marriage. My family, our relationships, our finances, you know, my sense of purpose and meaning in the world, my destiny. It took a few years to recover from that. It was really, really difficult. But we regained our feet. We found our bearings. We renegotiated how to be married again. And we're doing better now than ever. But yeah, it was a real struggle.
Was it the loss of income, the loss of the routine? Or was it your focus on some of the difficult parts of the message, the deconstruction, the queer community, the fact that religious communities aren't always accepting and loving and Christ-like?
When you grow up in the atmosphere of church or, you know, temple, what would you call it, temple?
Or church, I think, is super adequate for...
Yeah, so when you grow up in that, that's the air you breathe. And when I left the ministry, I live in the kind of a small kind of town that there were no options. Naked Pastor was kind of infamous already, and I was already infamous as a pastor, and so, you know, there wasn't anywhere we felt free to go. There is one church that we felt free to go, but it was like an hour and a half away, and we'd go there when we could. But when it's the air you breathe and everything, like when you walk into a church or when you're raised in a church, everything is handed to you on a silver platter. Your friendships, you've got mechanics, you got babysitters, you got people praying for you, you got potluck suppers, you got activities, you've got, you know, and as a pastor, you've got an income, you've got, you know, a plan, you've got a purpose for living, you've got a retirement, all this stuff. But when I left the ministry, we lost all our friends. We lost our church. We lost our meaning for living. Like, what do we do now? We had to file for bankruptcy. It was, our kids had left home. They were all adults, and they'd all left home. We were empty nesters. Lisa had gone to university to get her nursing degree. It was utter chaos, and it took us a few years, a lot of counseling, a lot of conversation, a lot of heartbreak, and to work things out and renegotiate how to live life again post church.
I think there are so many Latter-day Saints who are post-mo or ex-mo who are shaking their heads right now saying, you are speaking my language.
Yeah.
I completely understand.
Yeah.
Because this is such familiar territory for those who leave the church. You literally leave the community.
Yeah.
Aside from the only one thing I disagreed with was pay, because Latter-day Saints are lay leaders, so there is no pay in Mormon churches for bishops or lower tier ecumenical leaders. But aside from that, aside from the actual financial side of it, the loss of community, the sense of community that falls away, the babysitters, the ward friends, the neighborhood, everybody that's so involved in your life, they all disappear. They move on.
I compare it to like a lot of people who didn't grow up in the church or whatever. They don't relate. They don't understand really what you're talking about because they've never experienced that. And so I compare it to, it's kind of like you've got a brain tumor, but it's not just a lump. It's the kind that spreads its tentacles throughout your brain. And it's that kind of surgery that you could die. Like, it's like there's so many tentacles that reach out into every area of your life, your social life, what you eat, when you eat, what you do with your money, what kind of friends you can have, what you do during the weekend or weeknights, you know, how you talk, sexuality, everything is affected by your religious upbringing. So when you extricate yourself from that, it really is like, how do I do this? Like, it feels like you're starting from scratch. Yeah.
Let's talk about that process, because I think you've become the resident expert on deconstruction in faith communities. So let's talk a little bit about deconstruction.
Sure.
First, what is, when we talk about deconstruction, how would you define deconstruction?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I was in 2008, I think it was, I was asked to go to a pastor's workshop on, like a weekend workshop on hermeneutics, which is how to interpret the text or the Bible. And we were told to read a whole bunch of books beforehand, and they were basically all books on hermeneutics. And one of the things that we had to read up on was deconstruction, which is a philosophical theory out of France, Derrida. Derrida was the one who invented the word. And basically, it's you question everything about the text, everything, and that the text, you just can't know what the truth is about the text, etc. Anyway, that aside, I sort of loved the word deconstruction. I thought, you know, everything that they're I actually walked away from that conference. It was supposed to turn me off of deconstruction. It actually converted me. It turned me on to deconstruction. And I thought, you know, this is a great word to describe what I'm going through, where I'm questioning everything. Everything I'm questioning. And so I just started using the word in 2008 to describe what I was going through. Some people said, you sound like a deconstructionist. They meant it as an insult, but I took it as a compliment. And so basically what it just means is questioning. It could be everything from, was the earth really created in 6 days, to is there a God? Like everything is, nothing is immune from the being questioned. So that's what I mean by deconstruction, is just questioning everything.
Yeah. Why is really deconstruction become a big business? Why are so many religious institutions, organized religion specifically, fighting? I mean, it's almost as if deconstruction is Satan itself.
Yeah.
This idea that so many people, not just within the Latter-day Saint faith community, but other churches are experiencing mass amounts of deconstruction.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is the case?
You know, I think I just named something that has always been going on, but we called it backsliding before, where if you question your belief, that wasn't a good thing. I know that because that's what I grew up under, was if you question your beliefs, that was you being tempted and Satan speaking to you and you rebelling against God and so on. And so I think that's something that's always happened. But, you know, when people in the past started questioning their beliefs, they were either corrected or silenced or expelled. Those were the three options. You either fixed it or you shut up about it or you left. Those were the only three options. But now, and especially since COVID, people are realizing that they can ask questions and even leave the church without a whole lot of consequences, negative consequences. And from the church, I mean, there are consequences. But so I think that's why it's becoming, like I've seen videos and people saying, have you seen this, where these people talk about deconstruction, the demon of deconstruction, or it's from Satan and, you know, all this. I've been called the mouth of Satan myself. Just because I'm talking about deconstruction. But I think it's become normalized, and that's what's really scaring a lot of people who are a part of the structure or the system.
Do you see it kind of like the Gutenberg Bible era of of religion, where the movable type created the personal copies of the scriptures, and now people... I mean, I've often joked a little bit that it was Google that really... was the downfall of Mormonism. People were finally able to start understanding and researching the church's history.
Right.
They were also able to start connecting the dots in specifically to this topic in terms of LGBTQ understanding and messaging in the church.
Right.
When the Latter-day Saints were able to finally connect the dots and realize that their church leaders haven't always been favorable to the queer community. And when they were able to actually see it in real time via search engines and the internet, I kind of wonder, and I'm just curious, just opine on in your world, if you see this idea. I think COVID 100% played a role in this, but if you see things like the internet, deconstruction, all these things as being as monumentous as something like the Gutenberg Bible, the movable type, the Renaissance and Revolution periods that we've seen in religion.
Yeah, so I started talking about deconstruction in 2008. 2010, when I left the ministry, I talked about it more to the point where I realized, gee, I'm feeling kind of isolated here. That's the biggest pain point when people leave the church, is the loss of community. That's what I notice anyway. And so in 2012, I launched an online community called The Lasting Supper for people who were deconstructing, and where they'd have a safe place to vent and express themselves. And you know what? People were like, oh my goodness, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone. And I think that's what's happened, is a lot of people are realizing there's a whole lot of people who are just like me, questioning their beliefs, leaving the church, you know, and not believing the lies that they've been told. And it's like the internet has done that for sure. And I've always said there's only one way to deconstruct, and that's your way. And so that's really a rebellious thing to say. But a lot of people are figuring that out. They're like, you know what? I can decide how to be spiritual. And I can decide who to relate with and who to be friends with and who to surround myself with and what to read. Like, I can drive my own car. I can be the captain of my own ship and the master of my own destiny. And it's powerful. It's empowering for individuals to realize that. But it threatens everything that's gone on before.
I think you're spot on, especially in terms of your analysis of COVID. What in the COVID era, right. What happened really in Mormonism is that people, the Mormon Church also shut their chapels and went to an online or Zoom format for a lot of church services. So a lot of Latter-day Saints were no longer mingling with the saints.
Right.
They were no longer shoulder to shoulder. They weren't fulfilling what we call in Mormonism their callings, their duties and responsibilities within the church. They really were sitting at home, partaking of the sacrament sometimes as a home duty, right. As a home responsibility. But the church wasn't there. The church wasn't entangled in their lives on a weekly or multiple days throughout the week basis. And here were these Latter-day Saints who started realizing, look, my life hasn't fallen apart because I'm not attending church or church services 8 or 10 hours a week, which is pretty typical for Mormonism.
Yeah.
And I think that really started breaking down a lot of Latter-day Saints, where they saw that their world didn't crash when they were no longer giving 125% to the church.
Mm-hmm.
And the wheels start turning. So you mentioned something as you're talking about the deconstruction, and a few times you mentioned the word leaving. When somebody deconstructs and leaves a religion,
right,
where do they go? Because this is kind of we hear this from Mormon leaders often about if you leave the Mormon church, where will you go? Well, you'll go nowhere because there is nowhere else to go. And I think if one thing the Mormon church has done so effectively, it's taught that they are the end all when it comes to truth.
Right.
That there is no other truth out there greater than what the Mormon church will provide you. And so a lot of Latter-day Saints, when they leave Mormonism, they don't go anywhere else. They typically become agnostic or atheist. They just don't find new communities. Now, some do. Some find other pockets because they desire that sense of community. They want to still participate in religious services. They still want to be able to have a relationship with deity. But I'm curious, in your experience, where do people go when they leave, when they deconstruct? What are the typical roadmaps that people follow as they essentially leave the chapel pew?
So I think there's two kinds of deconstruction. And I've talked about this quite a bit, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. One is theological and the other is ecclesiological. So my experience and my observation is when people go through an ecclesiological deconstruction, that is when they leave the church, they don't necessarily deconstruct theologically. They could just be like, the church has gone corrupt, it's gone down a bad path, I want to go back to pure origins, you know, and they could even become even more fundamentalist in their beliefs. But people who deconstruct theologically often end up having to leave the church because there isn't a safe space for them to stretch and to grow and to question and to doubt and to come back around and all that kind of thing. I think the church is really great for carrying us through the first few steps of growth. But when we get to that independent phase, like adolescence, the church doesn't know how to handle that and it drops the ball. Well, what I've seen people do is, there's a couple of ways to answer this question. One is, some people, they stop going to church, and they figure out other ways to, like they join clubs or whatever. Or they find a church, a more progressive church, or a different kind of church. Or what I've seen is some people join an online community. I started an online community, The Lasting Supper, and people find their interaction there. The other way to answer that question is, I've written a lot about this, is I've watched a lot of documentaries and read a lot about cults. And when people leave cults, almost all of them are, they're in tears because they miss the intensity of community that they had. Even though they were being horribly abused, they miss that intensity of community. So I started thinking to myself, why is it the communities where I felt the most intense fellowship and community and intimacy were also the places where I experienced the most abuse? Like, that's a serious question. So a lot of people are starting to think, you know what? I've left the church. I do miss that community, but was it normal? Was it healthy? And they are figuring out new ways to form relationships. They're figuring out how to make friends. One of the things I realized was I was in the church and my friends were assigned to me, basically. Even Bible college, seminary, I had to learn, Lisa and I had to learn in our 50s how to make friends and how to keep friends. And we worked hard at it. Also because we've read a lot where the people who live the longest have a good social network around them. So we thought, honey, we want to live longer. We got to make some friends here. So we just started contacting people that we once knew or lost contact with and reconciled with some couples and so on. And we have a little group of friends now that we can get together with. It's hard work, but it does work. And so that's what Lisa and I have done.
I think this is a great door to open up in terms of giving some hope to those who are deconstructing and those who are on both sides of that deconstructive path, those who stay in church and also those who do pack up and leave. In your experience, because you've been able to deal with thousands of stories and be able to interact, I shouldn't say deal, you've been able to interact with thousands of different experiences. Mm. Is there happiness, joy, spiritual experiences, growth on the other side of that aisle?
Unequivocally, yes. Absolutely, yes. I mean, life is life. Life is hard. But what I've seen is the people who deconstruct and keep going, they don't retreat back or they don't jump into something else real quick where they'll end up having to deconstruct from anyway. People who keep going in their deconstruction, they're questioning, which I think is a lifestyle, a way of life, questioning everything always. We should be always questioning things, like what the media is giving us or what other people are giving us or culture or whatever, ads, billboards, television, movies, anything. We should always be questioning everything all the time. So deconstruction for me is a way of life. Once you sign up for deconstruction, it's for life until you die. And what I've discovered is I've never been happier. I feel more free than ever. My relationships are more solid and trustworthy and more diverse. And so for me, the beauty of diversity in my friendships and relationships, you know, me hanging out with Mormons, LGBTQ Mormons, is pretty cool. You know, today. So, you know, that's just an example. And I've seen that in so many people who are deconstructing is they're a lot happier. They feel more free than ever. They're working at establishing or building relationships and nurturing relationships. And, you know, they're free of the fear and the guilt and the shame that they always lived under.
I want to talk about, I'm a great segue into the LGBTQ community. Mm. I want to talk about your experience with the LGBTQ community because so many of your cartoons surround this topic. Mm-hmm. My first question is why? Why the LGBTQ community? Why the marginalized queer community?
As soon as the church says this far no further, then that indicates to me that there's a problem. The church is become exclusive. And so it seems to me that this is the hill the church is wanting to die on right now. And so that's why I'm fighting so hard. A lot of people think I'm an enemy of the church. Rather, I'm not. I hope I'm a friend of the church. I love the church. The church is like my mother from which I came. But I think it has a lot of issues. I think the church was created to serve us, not for us to serve it. And I keep challenging it to live up to its mandate to serve us and to serve everyone indiscriminately. And so way back in 2007 or 8, when I drew my first, what is called my first gay cartoon, it was when I'd had an experience where I had gay friends, I had trans friends, but I was in the ministry and I was in a rather conservative evangelical congregation, but I didn't have to. For me, there was no conflict with me as a person, but I knew there was conflict between them and the institution, the system. But I somehow, we could fly under the radar until I started drawing those darn cartoons and the word started getting out and I was forced to make a decision. And I was glad I left when I did, because a few years later, the church that I was a part of, that denomination, actually voted to not be affirming. So I left at the right time.
Describe to us that first cartoon, this first
Sure. Queer
cartoon.
Yeah, it's a lovely cartoon. I love it. It's one of my favorites. And I love it a lot, too, because it sort of put Naked Pastor on the map a little bit. But it shows Jesus walking hand in hand with another man. And the man says to Jesus, "I'm sorry, Jesus, but I think I'm gay." And Jesus says, "Relax, dude. I knew that long before you did." So it's just very poignant and, you know, very touching and moving. And what I love about it is it makes visible what I believe is true ideologically. Like, I believe it's true, that's true. That it's about love and acceptance and affirmation, non-judgmental, no fear, no guilt, no shame, no repentance, no forgiveness. It's just love. And so that's what I believe is true. And I drew it, which is why it's so encouraging to so many people and why it's so infuriating to so many people.
Was it encouraging because it spoke to the families of the marginalized community? Or was it encouraging to see that someone from the ecclesiastical realm, the pastoral side of their church, was actually discussing this topic?
To be honest, I think both goes on. But the people I hear from mostly is that, "Now that's my kind of Jesus." You know, that's the response I mostly get, is when someone sees a cartoon like that, they just feel affirmed, validated, that they're okay. They're not crazy. They're not sinful. They're all right. And sometimes, though, I do hear people saying, "I wish you were my pastor," or "I wish the church would listen to your cartoons," or whatever, things like that. But I just love hearing the individual stories from people about how they feel my cartoons have actually healed them from living under condemnation.
Yeah, I think this is fascinating territory, because I'm often in this space as well, where the lay Latter-day Saint, the typical Latter-day Saint, I call them pray, pay, and obey members, those who just want to do good,
yeah.
Who very often have a queer child or know someone really close to them who is LGBTQ, and they get it. They see over the kitchen table a real human being that they love, and they see the quirkiness, they see the intricacies, they see the beauty, they see the connection.
Yeah.
And I think not just in Mormonism, but that is true in many denominations, if not all denominations.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I think the disconnect comes when the church leader doesn't see that.
Right.
That the church leader is disconnected from that reality. And where the leaders of these religions aren't seeing their members in the fullest measure of their creation.
Right.
And so I can see why the cartoons resonate well with the member as opposed to the patriarchy, who seems to fight against it.
There's a lot of good pastors out there, affirming pastors who are part of denominations that aren't affirming. They're working so hard to change the ship's direction. And I admire them so much, and I have so much empathy for them, because I was one of those who graduated from seminary and went into the ministry wanting to be part of, you know, as the Presbyterians would say, the church is reformed and always reforming. And I wanted to be a part of that reforming movement in the church. But I came to a point where I could no longer do that from inside the system. Now, though, I feel like I have more influence than I did when I was inside. I think I frustrate so many people because I'm still in the game, but I'm not wearing the jersey or something. I don't know what's going on, but I'm still involved, still in the game, still playing, still scoring, but I'm not on a team anywhere. I'm on the marginalized team, and who aren't allowed on the field, but yet we're still winning. You know, it's kind of a weird analogy, but that's what it feels like.
It's got to be frustrating to church leaders. It's got to be frustrating to those who are still within the cloth that see that type of atmosphere and say, no, we're the ones that are supposed to have the following. Why are you, David, leading our people away?
Yeah. I get that a lot. I just got that today, that I'm leading people astray and misleading people and leading people away from the Lord. But I just read this on my way here on the airplane. I picked up GQ magazine, which I frequent now and then. And this month, they were featuring AOC and her being in politics and everything, and the sexism and the misogyny and the patriarchal system that she's encountering on a daily basis. And she speaks with such hope and energy and power and vision. And it kind of feels like that, where, you know, she's maligned and insulted and attacked and everything on a daily basis, even from her own party, the Democratic Party. But she's getting things done. And it's like she says, you know, the future world is here. It's small and it's here and there scattered, but it's definitely here and it's growing. And that's what it feels like. It's kind of like Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream, where it's a dream, but it's becoming a reality. And I want to be a part of that movement.
I'm curious what other queer cartoons you've drawn have made waves and have been popular, because as an artist and behind the scenes, you're able to see the analytics. What other cartoons have made a difference and have resonated well with the community?
I've got so many. One that I drew that is shows Jesus protecting a sheep while people are throwing stones at the sheep, but Jesus has his hand up and the stones are bouncing off his hand. Another one is where Jesus is just lying in the grass with a rainbow sheep, and the rainbow sheep says, "Thanks for being my friend," and Jesus says, "No, thank you for being my friend." Or the one where a rainbow sheep wants to come into a church, and Jesus is with the sheep, and the sheep inside the church that are all white leader sheep says, "Sorry, but you're not welcome here." And the next frame shows Jesus walking away with the sheep, and the white sheep are going, "Where'd Jesus go?" That one really upset a lot of people, because it's what it's saying is, Jesus is with the marginalized. The Spirit of Christ is with the marginalized. And if you don't welcome the marginalized, you're not welcoming the Spirit of Christ. That's really what it's saying. So actually, the ones who think they're in are out, and the ones who are said to be out are actually in.
And the first shall be the last.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the last shall be the first.
That's right.
Interesting how that ties together. Are there any cartoons? I'm always curious. Uh-huh. Are there any cartoons with special meanings? Meanings that as you drew them, there was something behind it that wasn't obvious in the text or wasn't obvious in the drawing?
Oh, that always happens. I hear from people all the time who are, you know, saying, "Did you notice that?" Or, "Did you do this on purpose?" Or things like that. But I really try hard to be, I don't want to be cynical or negative or just be attacking. I want it to be poignant. So for example, one cartoon, it shows a bunch of sheep trying to look in the windows of a church, and they're all on each other's shoulders. They're all rainbow sheep. And they're looking in the window, and one says, "Oh, he's saying God loves us. Yes, that's good, right?" And then the next one says, "Oh, wait a minute, he said but." Or another one where there's a guy on an operating table, and he has a protest sign, and it says, "God loves you, but." And there's God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit standing there, and they're going to operate. And God says, "We're going to have to remove your butt." So they're going to take the butt off the sign. So things like that, you know, I try to do those double entendres and, you know, double meanings and try to be funny and cute, but at the same time deliver a message with clout.
The message.
Yep.
The queer community. Mm. Their interactions with you. Mm-hmm. Now you've been at this for 15, 17 years.
17 years, yeah.
What have you heard from the queer community in regards to your art?
I get a lot of tons of encouragement. I really do. It's just overwhelming. And I've got queer friends all over the world in every country. And some are living in daily fear for their lives because some of the countries they're in are, it's illegal, you know. Torture, death penalty, illegal. And it's just, I'm amazed by the camaraderie, the love, the friendship, the grace, the compassion, the appreciation, the gratitude. It's really overwhelming. There are some people, I hear some negative sometime, where people are triggered by Jesus showing any kind of favor towards a queer person or a rainbow sheep or something, because that's not the Jesus they grew up with. So it's very triggering for them to see a false Jesus to them. And it can evoke anger in some people because the Jesus they have in their minds is condemnatory and judgmental and wrathful and exclusive. That's their experience of Jesus. And so I do hear from them, and I feel for them. I have a lot of empathy for them, and I don't know what to do about that. They'd rather I not draw. I suggest they block me. I don't know what to do about that, but I can totally empathize with the pain they must feel. When I was in the ministry, like I said earlier, I had gay, trans, bi, etc. friends. And so for me, it was all kind of under the radar. It didn't run into conflict with me personally. I knew it was in conflict with the general popular opinion out there in religious circles. So, but it never came to a point where I had to do anything about that. I had a gay friend, "Can I come to your church?" "Sure, absolutely, come to my church." Yeah, totally welcome, 100%. I knew we were in trouble, though, when my lesbian friend came with her girlfriend and they held hands. I knew, oh, here we go. Fasten my seatbelt. Now I got to deal with it, right? So it was that point where we started having to talk about it.
And when the queer person become visible.
That's exactly right.
It's okay to be queer. It's okay to have those feelings, but keep them hidden.
Yeah.
Stay in the closet. Don't show affection. No public displays of affection. Right. And then you'll be just fine.
Right. I didn't have a problem with them holding hands. I knew, though, it was going to cause a problem. But I'd left the ministry before a couple times. I'd been fired once. I'd left a couple times. I was ready to do it again. And sure enough, when 2010 came around, I knew my time had come for me to leave. Well, my advice to pastors are, if you can stay in the system and keep working towards turning that ship that can take a long time to change direction, to become more affirming, then, and you can do that without killing yourself, do it. But if you feel you know, draining the swamp when you're up to your ass, and alligators, as they say. There are other things you can do, and maybe more effective ways you can do your work. But my way, I was fortunate. I'd already been building Naked Pastor, doing my art and everything. I jumped into that. It took a few years to get it going full time, but that's what I'm doing now. So that's my advice. If you can stay, stay. If you can't stay, figure out a way to do the good work without the professional status. Yeah.
My advice often to Mormons in this situation, some of the healthiest deconstruction that I've seen in terms of Mormonism is separating the gospel of Jesus Christ from Mormonism.
Right.
From the organized, man-made portions of religion.
Right.
And allow them still to grasp on the general principles, the very basic principles of the gospel.
Right.
Which really simply is love.
Right.
And love each other.
Yeah.
Which has really been something that's been important to the LGBTQ community.
Mm.
What is your advice to the LGBTQ community, coming from someone who has been on the pastoral side of religion, someone who has walked away from that, someone who has recognized the queer community, when it comes to still embracing a faith and still embracing an identity as a son, daughter, or child of God? What is your advice from your pew to the queer community?
So my number one advice is always keep yourself safe. That's my always number one. If you don't feel safe coming out or feel safe where you are, just make all the necessary steps that you can take to keep yourself safe. That's number one. Number two is take steps that where you can come out or where you can be your total free, authentic self, create an environment where you will be safe. So it's kind of like many abused wives I know who they wait until their husband's gone. They've already set up steps. They've got hidden money. They've got a suitcase packed. They've got friends' phone numbers. They've got a place they can go stay. Everything is set up, and that they've got a whole new life planned. And then they take that necessary step that takes a lot of courage to start a new life. So that basically it's the same for my gay friends and so on, is do it safe, have a plan, and then come out at your own pace. Nobody's got a gun to your head to do it at a certain speed. Like, just do it in your own way. And then, like, create your world. Create your world, the kind of world you want. Get the friends you want. Get the community you want. Find a community online that you want. Read what you want to create that kind of a new world for yourself where you feel normal, that you're okay, and that you're loved, and that you're protected and supported.
Beautiful. I love it. Along that same thread, as you were speaking, I was thinking of the parents of queer kids or adults who come out. And I'm sure you've had interactions with those types of family members, specific parents, specifically parents who come to you or to other influential people with a white flag saying, my child has come out, it's all over. What is your advice to that mother or father whose son or daughter or child has just come out to them as queer or trans, bisexual, any?
Yeah. When our kids were young, Lisa and I made an agreement, like they were coming up to their teen years. And we knew intuitively that we're in for trouble. And so we made a decision. And we were surrounded by religious parents, you know, other religious parents with their own kids and stuff. And we saw what could happen, that there's a lot of parenting by fear-based parenting. And Lisa and I decided that we were going to nurture our relationship over being right all the time. It was more important to stay in relationship with our kids than to be right or for them to obey our wishes or to fulfill our fantasies or meet our expectations. I'll tell you, the teen years that we went through was many years, because they're like five, all three of them are like 5 years apart. It was a long time that we went through of really a lot of chaos. But you know what? They're our best friends now. They're our best friends because they're totally independent. They're totally individual, totally unique, totally themselves, free to be themselves and to express themselves. They're incredible human beings, and we have a good relationship with them. And it's the same with parents of queer kids, trans kids, or whatever. If you make a plan, it's more important for me to be in relationship with my kid than to be right, or for them to fulfill some kind of a ideological, you know, law book or whatever. It's more important that we love each other. That's how it works. That's just how it works. And it's better. It's a better way to live. It's a better way to be happy. It's a better way to have a family. It's a better way to have love. It works right down to our spouses. I'm going to love her, or I'm going to love him, however she manifests, because I'm in love with their core authentic self. And I'm going to stand back and awe and wonder as she unfolds, or as he unfolds. That's how love works. And that includes in parenting too.
Beautiful. I'm curious if there are any regrets. You've had a 180 degree turn from what your life looked like 17 years ago. Any regrets?
I can't say I do have any regrets. Now I wanna clarify something. I have made a 180 degree turn in one way, but in another way, I see my life as a trajectory. Like I've been going in this direction. I used to think of growth as linear, but that gave the impression we left things behind, or it was all history and behind us. Then I thought maybe it's stage, where we go through stages of growth. But then that gave the impression that you look down on your former self and sort of as inferior, less than, below us. But now I think of growth as spatial, where we grow outward to include everything that's come before. So I was born and baptized Anglican. I went to every church. I call myself my own ecumenical movement because I've been to so many churches. Was Pentecostal, Presbyterian, Independent, Vineyard, done some crazy things, experienced some crazy things, believed crazy things. But I wouldn't be who I am now unless I was who I was then. It's all sort of like compost folded in to make the very rich, nutritious soil out of which I express myself. And so that's the way I see, like, Mormons who are coming out of Mormonism. Don't reject anything. Just, it all gets folded in like manure and dirt. It makes compost. It's the bad stuff and the good stuff. When together, it can make a real nutritious soil out of which we grow. So my past, your past, as weird and variegated and diverse as it is, it all somehow folds together to make us who we are today.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
I really like that analogy. because it resonates so well. That is a really excellent descriptor of so many people's experiences.
Yeah.
And as it should be, we shouldn't have to wallow in the mire for the rest of our lives. We should be able to literally bloom where we're planted. And we're planted in those areas that are full of our history.
That's right. Like, who here is embarrassed that they believed in Santa when they were a child? I am not embarrassed. I believed some crazy things when I was a kid. But it makes me who I am today. Who knows how that all that belief in Santa contributed to my feelings of generosity or surprise or wonder or, you know, gift giving or, you know, magic or whatever. And so, you know, with my Pentecostal past and my Presbyterian Reformed past and my Anglican past and, you know, mystical past and New Age past and all this stuff, these are all streams that formed into one river who's called David Hayward right now. And I'm still changing right before your eyes, right? So that's just the nature of personal growth.
Let's talk about the future. What does the future look like for the Naked Pastor? We know a little bit about what the future looks like for David. Well, where's the future for the Naked Pastor? What's up? What's coming up? What should we expect?
Well, I just came out with a new book, so flip it like this, and it's my best of cartoons. So I was forced to melt 4,000 plus cartoons down into 125 cartoons for my best of book. So you can get that anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Indie Books, Barnes & Noble. But it would be great if you pick one of those up. But that just came out in July. But yeah, more writing. I want to write more about deconstruction. I want to defend and normalize deconstruction for more people. I want to be on the front lines of fighting for the normalizing of the LGBTQ community within the human race and within religion and the church and so on. And I'm going to keep doing what I do until I die.
Your website, where can our listeners find more of your cartoons and more of your products? Yeah. Because you have mugs and t-shirts.
Yeah, I have a ton. I sell my prints, and I also am a painter. I do watercolor landscapes and other stuff. So nakedpastor.com, that's home base. My most active community, I would say, is Instagram, Naked Pastor. It's very busy. 115,000 followers, and I work very hard at keeping that a safe place.
Was there anything we haven't talked about in this episode that you wanted to talk about? Things that maybe we should have clarified, touched on?
My sex life, but we'll keep that to myself.
Hey, there's a separate podcast for that, right?
Yeah. No, Lisa and I have been married now 42 years. Wow. And never been happier. We deconstructed together and side by side. I actually wrote a book about it, Till Doubt Do Us Part, When Changing Beliefs Change Your Marriage. And it's helped a lot of people too. But and our three kids, I love what I do. I love being involved. A lot of people saying, hey, you left the church. Why don't you just leave us alone? Or, you know, why aren't you gone yet? It's because I feel I'm in that margin between people who are in the church and people who are outside, but who still want to integrate everything together, including their religious past. So I want to continue working to help people make sense of that in healthy ways.
I love it.
Yeah.
This has been an excellent episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing a little bit of your background, your story. But personally, thank you for opening the world to a topic that is unfamiliar to them, specifically that of the queer community. Thank you for shining light and giving visibility to this topic where so many other church leaders not just would, but have passed this community by.
Yeah.
Mainly because of its small in number. But I can't help but think, like, if we're talking about religion, we're talking about the 90 and 9, and leaving the 90 and 9 to find the one. Mm-hmm. And just as a personal thank you, I want to say thank you for finding the one. Thank you for drawing and bringing attention to the one.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'm humbled. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
We're thrilled to have David Hayward here on the podcast. So thank you again for sharing your story. If there was something in this episode that resonated well with you and you want to connect with David, as he talked about, the Instagram is there. Also his website, nakedpastor.com. You'll see we share his cartoons frequently, but they're all over the interwebs. You definitely will, just a simple Google search will find them as well. So I encourage you to seek out more of those cartoons and support David as he continues to support the LGBTQ community. And again, we want to thank you for giving us an hour of your time to better understand this intersection of sexuality and religion, and to hear another story and draw a little closer to the LGBTQ community. Again, if you are watching this on a video episode, we invite you to share this episode. We are broadcasting this episode on YouTube and our Facebook channel. It's also available online at lattergaystories.org. If you are listening to an audio version of this episode, wherever you catch your favorite audio podcasts, we invite you to subscribe to this channel and also give us a rating. By doing those two things, it does help expand our reach and it allows us to build bigger and stronger bridges between the LDS and LGBTQ community, essentially by creating more visibility. So for those of you that are sharing our episodes, that are commenting on our episodes, that are interacting with our episodes, I say thank you, because that is one of the greatest things that helps this podcast and our reach. Again, we want to thank you for sharing a little bit of your time today. Again, one last thanks to David for him coming into the studio and being so candid and open with his vision of what the world, especially the religious world, should look like. Again, thank you. Subscribe, share, like, and continue to be the good people that you are to the LGBTQ community. It's stories like yours, it's stories like mine, and it's stories like David's that help us each to continue writing our own Latter Gay Story.
This episode is a production of Latter Gay Stories. We are always looking for new friends. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Latter Gay Stories. The podcast is made possible because of generous donors like you. Make a donation now. Your donation gives us the ability to build bigger bridges by producing more Latter Gay Stories. Want more? Find this episode and others online at LatterGayStories.org.